Welcome to the Space Show, Darren.
Yep, thank you.
Now, what is BlueSat?
BlueSat. It was a project derived back in 1997 for the students. It was derived by a couple of students to launch a satellite, build, design, and launch a satellite within 2 or 3 years. This didn't eventuate, and it became a full engineering, full-scale satellite project.
Where were these students?
These students were engineering students, part of the Space Frontier Society, part of the NSSA in Sydney. And we had a student chapter at the University of New South Wales. Various things occurred, and they weren't really sure what payload they wanted to build or what type of satellite they wanted to build, but eventually it came to the fact they wanted to build a microsatellite. So this microsatellite, BlueSat, stood for Basic Low Earth Orbit, University of New South Wales Experimental Satellite. So yeah, it's a 26 centimeter cube covered in solar cells, and it's got its radio package and antennas stick out. It's like a little box, and four antennas on the bottom and a long antenna on top.
And it is within the capabilities of students to develop such a satellite, is it?
Yes, it's definitely well within capability of students. Many amateurs around the world have built these, especially such groups such as AMSAT-NA. We felt that it would be a definite challenge, and that's why it draws so many engineering students towards the project. There are a lot of problems associated building a satellite. One is there's no experience or nothing to learn from how to build a satellite. The second thing would be...
And it's even though thousands of satellites have actually been launched.
That's right. Thousands have been launched, but not many have been built in Australia. We've only built three to this current date. ReSat, which was 1969, Oscar 5 in 1970, and then FedSat, which is going to be launched in December, mid-December. So... yes, it's in around the world. Lots of people have built satellites, but Australia has sort of fallen behind the eight ball.
So we need to sort of relearn the skills, as it were.
That's definitely correct, and especially because all the technology has changed. You've had to, back then, solar cells were very low power and low efficiency. Nowadays, they're up to 18% to 24%. So that's a huge phenomenal jump. Also, electronics have changed. You got microprocessors these days, small electronics. You can do a lot of things on one chip these days, so it's an interesting thing.
And is it that new electronics, that new generation of equipment, that makes it possible to build such a satellite? Because one thinks of, you know, some of these satellites cost hundreds of millions of dollars, and obviously that's way beyond the capability of even the Australian government.
That's correct. You have a lot more functionality these days because microtronics, like if you had... back in the 1980s, the best processor out there would have only been an Intel 386 or less. These days, you've got a whole variety of microprocessors, such as your Pentium 4s, your Durons, Strong Arms, things like that. And they're very capable processors, and it's because of this increased capability it's given the students to have increased flexibility. So they've been able to design payloads to match their needs.
So you're going to develop this box with wings on it. What are you going to put inside it?
Mainly, a traditional satellite would have the platform systems. Platform systems would be your communications, your power source of some sort. Desired power source would be solar panels, because it's a renewable source of energy and it's cheaper than nuclear sources, and that's not a possible option in Australia as well. Also a flight computer to control the systems on board and payloads.
And what's the payload going to be? What do you mean by payload, by the way?
Payloads. After you've built your basic satellite, you have to then have some experimental data or a desired thing you want to put in space. For example, it might be a communications payload. It's more like the purpose of the satellite. The main goal of the satellite is to achieve something, and the payload meets that goal quite easily.
So what's the payload going to be?
Our payload would be... mainly three payloads. We're looking at a packet store and forward system, so it's basically like an FTP server. It also allows people to remotely download and upload data for like such things like remote health and sensing, like if you've got people on the outback who need to upload data and get it downloaded to the nearest physician. There would be vast distances, and the cost of phone lines are very expensive in the outback, but if they use this very inexpensive data system that we've developed, that is quite possible. Also, we've got an imager on board and a GPS system. The imager is a color imager which would take photos, not the best photos, but a wide angled view photo, color of the Earth, and also a GPS system to monitor how the atmosphere works and also how fast the satellite is moving and the positioning.
What's GPS?
GPS is it's a relatively new thing. It was derived in the 1970s and fully operational about 1990s. They use it for global positioning, so you have a little receiver which takes input data from all these satellites that are floating around this orbital plane, and it correlates all the data onto your little GPS receiver, and you can actually find out the exact position within a meter where you are on any point of the Earth.
Or in space.
Or in space, in this case, and that's where we'll be experimenting.
Okay, and speaking of in space, how far out in space will the satellite be?
This depends on the launch vehicle, or the rocket. It depends on what they give us, because we're going for a free subsidized launch or a cheaper launch. So this could go from 400 kilometres to 1,000 kilometres.
And speaking of the launch then, how much does it cost to get something into space?
Oh, that's a different question altogether. Because there are not many people launching things these days, the only serious contenders are like the Americans with the space shuttle and the Titans and the Deltas, the Chinese and the Russians, and who else would there be? Arianespace, which is in France, and they launch in French Guiana. Those guys charge around rates of $20,000 a kilo. It's a bit excessive, so for our satellite, which is about 15 kilos, that equates about $300,000 US, and it's a bit difficult to raise those types of funds.
That might well cost more than your satellite.
It has costed about two or three times in that magnitude, so...
So obviously you're not in that sort of league, so how are you going to get your payload into space?
The best way is to offer services to for sponsorship, or have a payload that is tailored for a specific launch provider that they want to test. For example, Ariane might want to use some services on our satellite or put an experiment on board, and in exchange they'll give us a free launch. Those things can happen. Generally, they would ask for a small sum of money as well, but it's all up in the end. This point in time, until the economy recovers a bit, I think the global economy, we might look again.
Okay, why are you developing this?
Mainly, it's a challenge, I believe, because looking back from 97 and then all the way to 1970s. Which was our last satellite. There's been a bit of a gap, and Australia has sort of was on the forefront of satellite and space technology, but unfortunately didn't take the path towards it. We felt that, you know, there's got to be more exciting things out there, and there's only one limit that any person aspires to, and that's space, the stars. So we felt that if we can get closer to it, reaching our goals, you know, the ultimate pinnacle of all goals, getting out there. So as engineering students, we watch a lot of Star Trek, that's one. And then the second one would be trying to build things that fly in space. And understanding those things and the challenge of doing it has driven a lot of us to stay on and build it.
Are you also building up links and so on with industry and the academic community in doing this project?
Definitely. A lot of research institutes such as Australian Space Research Institute, the University of New South Wales, all the universities in Australia have helped us considerably towards our building efforts, also in terms of technical details. More specialised knowledge has come from the amateur radio community, AMSAT-NA, which is the Amateur Satellite Corporation in North America. Those guys have been launching satellites on a steady pace for the last 30, 40 years. They started with Oscar 5, and now they're up to, satellite number 43 or 44, so they're a very successful group in launching satellites. Also, a lot of aerospace companies such as Boeing, Surrey Satellite Technology, Arianespace, NASA, they've all had contribution to our project.
And what are the students reacting, or how are they reacting to it at the University of New South Wales?
I think they've reacted in a positive way. That is, they understand that if they put some effort into building this satellite, they would actually get possibly a more stronger engineering experience and also a more knowledgeable entry to the space and aerospace markets, because it's such a competitive market to get into. If you want to become an astronaut or if you wanted to become an aircraft designer, this projects like BlueSat project is an ideal way to give you the experience to do this. So I thoroughly encourage all students to look for space projects if they're keen to become the astronaut or keen to do some real spacey stuff.
So do they come beating on the lab door to join?
They do, until we show them the workload, and then they sort of get deterred. So nothing comes easy. Everything comes through hard work, I guess. So, yeah, don't be surprised if you've got a lot of work to do to become an astronaut.
Now, can anyone just chuck a satellite into orbit, or do you need to go through some licensing procedure in order to do that?
Back in the olden days, you could just throw it up, but now, because there's all these space debris problems, we do have to register through three or four institutions and organisations. The first one will be the Australian Space Licensing Organisation. They're called SLASO, and we have to obtain a space licence in order to release an Australian-built spacecraft into orbit. This is for liability and international regulation. The second one would be you have to frequency register as well, because there's no point, you know, sending a satellite up there and not having any way to communicate to it. The only way that is feasible is to use a radio link, and these radio links have to be coordinated through the International Telecommunications Union, the Amateur Radio Union as well, AMSAT, and the ACA in Australia. So that's another thing that we have to consider. The third thing would be export licensing and insurance. So
you mean to say that if this thing falls out of the sky and hits us, we're insured?
That's pretty much it, yeah. Not only that, if we launch and we are the cause of a massive rocket blowing up, we insure them as well. So it's a very difficult thing to do, I guess, but you have... Everybody insures these days, and
you must be building up quite a pile of paperwork then.
Yeah, the paperwork. We try to avoid it, but you can't avoid the paperwork if you want to build a satellite. We've equated enough paper to be as high as our engineering building, so it's about 5 or 6 floors already. A lot of it is computer data work as well, but the documentation in order to achieve these qualifications. And these testing qualifications and also this insurance and legal documentation is a big procedure as well.
Okay, there must be quite a bit involved in building a satellite. Do you just go out and buy stuff off the shelf, or do you have to make it all yourself?
Not really. It's more of a... you have to go through some criteria, that is the space criteria. These, for example, they have a certain level of... certain materials only have certain properties. And if you put them in the space environment, they generally can degrade or do funny things. One example would be PVC. If you had a PVC coated wire and you put that into space, the whole wire in vacuum actually evaporates away. It explodes. So you would have to then consider the effects of all the materials you put in the satellite physically. Then also you have another problem called radiation. Radiation is the stuff that comes from the sun. It's gamma rays, protons, neutrons, X-rays. Over time, they will degrade your componentry as well. So you try to select more radiation-tolerant components, such as older technologies. The third thing that you'll have to consider is any other orbital environments or oxygen that's floating around. Atomic oxygen is another thing that oxidizes your satellite, so you got to be careful. And
what you mean to say, space is not totally empty?
No, it's not totally empty at all. If you go out to about 600 k's, you'll still get a bit of atomic oxygen, that is single oxygen atoms floating around.
Okay, and you'll be hitting them at about 28,000 kilometres an hour.
Oh, definitely. That's the right math, yep. It's like a bullet hitting another bullet, so the oxygen particle could be going the other direction, or a speck of paint, or because there's so much space debris out there, they could be travelling in all different directions, and you're travelling at 27,000 k's in the other direction, or 28. It becomes a 56,000 kilometre per an hour collision. It's like a bullet.
Okay, so you've got your satellite up there at about 750 kilometres or so, and it's got some experiments collecting pictures and stuff. How do you get all that information back to Earth?
That's where your radio communication link comes in. We actually have a couple of antennas that are in our ground station. They're just very long TV antennas. They work on 435 megahertz and 145 megahertz. And we've got a modem built onto the satellite, which then takes the data from the computer, modulates it, and then sends it down. And on Earth, we do the reverse. We demodulate it. It's almost like a phone line. You've got a 56K modem on your end, computer. On the other end, there will be another 56K modem, and you do a transfer that way.
And these ground stations that you're going to pick up the signals from, do they have to be operated by experts, or can they be operated by say, kids, for example?
They probably can be, because if you're not, most of the time you don't transmit. Most of the time you try to receive first. That's the first aim. That's the first thing they teach you. Hear things first, then talk. Same applies for the ground station. Therefore, anybody can receive satellite signals without a problem. You don't need a license to receive. What you'll need is a license to transmit, which you'll need an amateur radio license. But besides that, high school kids have received many, shall we say, satellites and weather faxes from fax satellites, satellites that are weather satellites. Such people would have been the Melbourne University kids back in 1970s with AO5. And recently there were two schools called Knox Grammar in Sydney and Ravenswood Girls High School. They were involved with the Russian Calibri project, and it was a satellite that was launched from the ISS, and they had to collect data samples off this satellite before it re-entered. And they built their own ground stations and collected data, so it was fantastic for them.
So any schools out there that want to take part in this, what could they do?
They can probably look around, I think, or contact us. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Our website is www.bluesat.unsw.edu.au, and you can see something about our project, and there should be some contact details if you're interested to find out some more information. Besides that, such high schools such as Cherrybrook High School, they've decided, have approached us to fly a UV experiment on board our satellite. That has a piece of Lexan film, and that Lexan is the planned Mars habitat greenhouses to reflect all the UV light. Now, not many people have proved that Lexan reflects UV light or protects the Mars inhabitants if there is that plastic used. So we're going to fly this piece of Lexan and put a UV sensor on the other end. And if the UV passes through the sensor, then the Lexan has failed. But if it doesn't, then we know it will survive a certain duration. So that's a high school payload, and we invite a lot of high schools if they can think of a really good payload to put on our spacecraft, like a simple thing like that. Please contact us as well.
Okay, and when do you expect to fly?
We're looking at a 2004 launch date. That is also depending if anybody gives us a cheap or free discount launch. If that's the case, then yes, 2004 will be our launch date. But if we get one off, there'll be two satellites, three satellites, four satellites. We'll build a whole chain of them. So everybody in Australia would have an opportunity to put some payloads on.
Well, we look forward, Darren, to hearing about the launch of this in the coming years.
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. Really
thanks for joining us on the Space Show.
Okay, thank you very much.